That is what consciousness is about. It's about creating the not disputable fact that I am doing my perceptions and you are doing your perceptions. And the two channels of operation are, and then the two kinds of operation are of the same type, but they are occurring in different organisms.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Antonio Damasio. Dr. Damasio is an internationally recognized neuroscientist whose extensive research has shaped the understanding of neural systems and consciousness. With over 100 journal articles and book chapters, he has earned many prestigious awards throughout his career. Currently, he serves as university professor, the David Dornzeif Professor of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Philosophy, and director of the Brain Creativity Institute at the University of Southern California. His books, Descartes' Error, Looking for Spinoza, Self Comes to Mind, The Strange Order of Things, and Feeling and Knowing, have been published in translation and are taught in universities throughout the world. In this stimulating episode, I talk to Antonio Damasio about consciousness. People often think that the mind and consciousness are the same thing, but Dr. Damasio disputes this notion. He argues that it's the complex relationship of both our brains and bodies that makes sentient thought possible. Homeostatic feelings like hunger and pain developed before emotions, and along with it came consciousness. We also touch on the topics of perception, mental illness, evolution, panpsychism, AI, and machine learning. So it's with great enthusiasm that I now bring you Dr. Antonio Damasio.
It's nice to finally meet you. We have some mutual friends in common. I'm dear friends with Mary Helen and Mardino Yang.
Oh, great.
Highly, very highly of you. And it's just, nice to finally meet you.
She's having a beautiful career. Yeah, I think the first person we appointed to the Brain Creativity Institute now, I think 17 years ago.
Wow, time really does fly. Wow. Yeah. That's how long ago you guys started that. I remember when you started the Institute. And
that's exactly it. Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, today I definitely want to discuss our mutual interest in the neuroscience of creativity. But I wanted to start off today's episode going back, all the way back to 1989. One of my favorite papers of yours in the journal Cognition called Time-Locked Multi-Regional Retroactivation. Now, we're going to have to explain and unpack what in the world that means to our general audience of listeners. But the reason why I wanted to double-click on that is because I think that was a really seminal paper, I hope you agree, of modern-day brain network systems research on consciousness. I see that as a really seminal sort of early ideas. So could you kind of unpack a little bit what that paper showed?
So we were interested in the idea that as you manipulate knowledge, perceptions of every kind, different considerations that we make on what we're perceiving, on what we're thinking about, based on those perceptions, on all of that, needs to be stored in some way, and the storage, in no likelihood, proceeds by creating arrangements of memories, of traces of all of those events near the places in the brain where they are formed to begin with. So we have a number of portals into our brain that largely come out of the dominant perceptual systems, particularly, of course, the visual and the auditory, which clearly dominate in most individuals, and then all the other senses that we know of. And what is interesting is that the channeling of information from the sensory probes that are located in the periphery of our body and also the periphery of our nervous system, and the central part of the nervous system, they all land in different parts of the brain, which is, of course, predictable because we have a channel that goes, for example, from our eyes to a particular region of the cortex, which happens to be visual cortex. And then the place where the things that you're hearing right now, or that I'm hearing of my own voice, they land in another place. And then out of those hubs where information is being sent to, you have the possibility of creating a sort of encircling where you have not only the immediate processing of what is being channeled at the moment. In this case, for example, I'm looking at your face and your bookcase behind you. You're listening to my voice and probably looking at whatever I have behind me. And so there's that early sensory processing, but then all around, there's structures that can actually take apart the information that is coming in and provide storage for that information, sometimes in a piecemeal form, sometimes in a holistic form. So you have the possibility of creating memories for what is being processed right now. And then depending on how important those things are for your life, they may stay on as permanent memories and be transformed, or they may be just disposed of in the course of life. And then what is interesting too is that most of the time, our perceptions are not occurring in one modality only. So for example, right now, there is a visual perception that we're both having, an auditory perception, but also, lo and behold, we have the perception, quote unquote, of what is happening in our own body. For example, if all of a sudden you could be feeling hungry or thirsty, or you could have pain somewhere, that would be perceived as well, except that that would be arranged in a different kind of system. There's a cortical component to it too, as well. But by and large, it doesn't happen in the cortex. The most important parts, they happen in the brainstem, they happen in the spinal cord. So you can have all of this fabrication of traces of things that are happening to you inside your body and around you. They go to specific points in the nervous system, not in one. It's very interesting as a parenthesis that very often people that don't know anything about the brain or about the mind studied in detail can perfectly well believe that all of this is going into one great big tank, one great big sink, and is all put together. But it isn't. It's all separated at birth. It's all separated and goes into different points. And those different points where it occurs, they already are sign of a convergence of signals. And then from there, they can go to another set of stations where further integration of the signals is done. And by, again, a process of convergence of signaling, a little bit of a pyramid going into a point. And then eventually you can have combinations of those different pyramids, of those different hooking points, and create something that is much larger. That's the great picture that I had for the convergence from multiple regions. And then what is interesting is that eventually you can have a combination of facts. For example, right now I'm talking to you. I have my perception of you. I know that I'm talking to you about this particular process, which is really a process of learning and categorization and memory making. But I also know that I just talked to my assistant and we talked about a couple of specific things that I need to get done as soon as I'm done talking to you. And I'm also looking at a page from Corriere della Sera, that's the Italian newspaper, where there is a review of my new book. And
was it good? Was it positive?
It's very good. It's lovely.
Yeah, good. Congrats.
Oh, it says, it's a lovely title, Body and Feeling, The Romance of Damasio.
Nice. I love it. You can't get better than that, you know, from that. Yeah.
Right. It's done by a major Italian biologist. Anyway, so all of this stuff is being integrated. And what is interesting is that if next week you call me and you remind me of this session we're having, I could perfectly well remember not only parts of this conversation, but part of what I just told you about that particular review that happens to be on my desk. So things have a way of being integrated by the time at which they're occurring, but also by the happenstance of being here at the right moment. And so things that are not linked will be linked because at that time, in this case, the time in which I am talking to you, my eyes also fell on that page that was here on my desk, actually just behind you. Anyway, so that's what I had in mind. And it has proven helpful to explain problems of memory as well as making normal memory, because we know that when you can damage one part of the system, you don't lose memory across the board. You lose certain specific memories and memories of certain kinds, for example, that may be more related to the visual system than to another. Anyway, very complicated answer for a very complicated subject.
Yeah, it's a very complicated paper. You know, but the reason why I bring this up is because I think it's extraordinary. It was a theoretical paper, and it seems to have really a modern day work, which is really focused on systems level and brain networks, has really borne out a lot of those ideas, if not all of those ideas. So I think it's kudos to you. Kudos to you.
Thank you very much.
There's a sentence in that paper that I wanted to link to your more modern work. And let me just read this. You write, meaning is reached by time-locked multi-regional retroactivation of widespread fragment records. Say that 10 times really quickly. only the latter records can become contents of consciousness. I found that a very fascinating two sentences for a number of reasons. One, there does seem to be something unique about humans, or uniquely developed about humans, in terms of our meaning-making facilities. And I'd love to kind of get into what is the neural machinery and psychological processes that allow us to do that, and why turtles can't do that, for instance. Second of all, that second sentence, only the latter records can become contents of consciousness. I wonder if you could unpack that a little bit, because you go through a lot in your new book on the distinction, the crucial distinction between mind and consciousness. And so I'm linking the distinction of mind and consciousness, which you make so clearly now, with that very complicated sentence that I just read from your 1989 paper. I hope you're okay with that linkage I made. I think it makes sense in my head.
I think it makes perfect sense. But let's actually start with the things that pertain to the new book, because that may help unpack the older sentence. And what I'm trying to do there, that distinction between mind and consciousness is critical for a variety of reasons. First, by and large, people confuse the two. And you know, it's as if creatures that are minded be necessarily conscious, and the two things would go together and could be interchangeable. And that's not the case. The same way, actually, in our conversation yesterday by email, you mentioned something about your interests in covert processing, in things that are not, in fact, in the mind, that have to do with an intelligence that is capable but is not minded. And these are all different parts of this great big thing that we call our conscious minds, and that include a lot of unconscious processes. So if you take simple creatures, I wouldn't start with turtles, but I would start with something even simpler, like bacteria, or a variety of creatures with only a few cells and a few nucleated cells. Those creatures have no nervous system to begin with, and yet they are intelligent and capable within the niche of universe in which they operate. And they can perfectly well detect the presence or absence of something, which is really a form of perception, quote unquote, not a perception like we have, with detailed imaging.
It's like sensing. They're very good.
Exactly. Sensing. Yeah, detecting and sensing are good words for that, except that very often they connote other things in the mind of people, and they can add to the confusion. But anyway, they can detect, sense stuff, and they can, with the machinery that they have, respond in a certain way that is consonant with what they detect. Now, that is an intelligent thing to do. There's no question that it is adaptive and intelligent, and it is protecting them, because they may detect something that they need, such as, for example, food, a food particle, or they may detect something that is potentially harmful, and that's good because it's going to protect their body and to allow them to live as long as their machinery is meant for it to live, genetically speaking. Now, so that is intelligent, but not minded and not conscious. Now, when you turn to what we do at the other end and what many other creatures do in between, we have not only the capacity to detect, sense stuff, but then we also have the capacity to represent what we detected and also represent ourselves as victims of the detection. And we have the capacity to know that all of that relates to our unique organism. So these three tiers are very, very important to separate. And unfortunately, in the minds of most people, this is one great big salad. And what I'm trying to do, if you ask me, what is the most important thing that I think I'm doing right now, in addition to explaining stuff that I'm passionate about, such as how you get to have a feeling, is actually insisting on this separation. So you have a mind when you are capable of representing something that you detected. And fortunately for us, we have the capacity to represent tons of things depending on the different sensory channels we have. Things outside of our bodies and inside of our bodies. Then we have an intelligence, provided we are capable of responding to things that are in our environment, but not necessarily representing them. And then we are conscious when we connect the thing that we are mindful of with our own organism. The beauty of consciousness is that, for example, I'm looking at you. I know that it's me looking at you. Why do I know that? Well, that's exactly the problem of consciousness. The image that you are helping generate in my brain is activating a variety of systems that are in my brain and body, and that connect the two indelibly and in such a way that I have no doubt that it's me talking to you, Scott. There's no question. That is what consciousness is about. It's about creating the not disputable fact that I am doing my perceptions and you are doing your perceptions. And the two channels of operation, the two kinds of operation are of the same type, but they are occurring in different organisms.
Yeah, for sure. And this is a really unique aspect of your theory of consciousness, which not everyone in the field has this definition of consciousness. You know, there's panpsychism is really hot right now, right?
Yeah.
Panpsychic people wouldn't say it. You have to have that criteria of the organism being able to identify it with itself in order for it to be conscious. And this makes your work very unique and very influential, that you really are arguing that there's a very important distinction. A lot of people in the field do not make this distinction. You know, we should make that clear. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that if you don't make those distinctions, I think you actually end up in the place that led to panpsychism. I think there is a very good reason why panpsychism at the moment is popular, and that is an escape. People that have come up against the wall of consciousness and that talk about such things as the heart problem or the impossible problem are really obstructed in their view of what can be. And as a result, almost anything goes, but panpsychism is helpful because, well, you know, maybe the reason why you can't explain it easily is because it's everywhere and something is not inside us. It's really something that we capture from what's around us, which I find, first, no evidence for, and second, no way of testing, no way of doing an experiment that would cope with that.
It's like string theory. It's like string theory in physics.
But I think I can understand. I have sympathy for people that feel cornered and not capable of explaining it. But I am, sympathy is one thing. I'm not in that camp. And there's one thing, let me add, because that, you know, we really, through your question, we sort of got to the top of the problem.
I know.
very quickly. But one thing that is extremely important for me is this. Most of the things, probably everything that you read about consciousness, or for that matter, about mind, always talks about the brain alone. You know, people say we need to find out how the brain creates consciousness. Excuse me? Why just the brain? Why this insistence on the fact that the nervous system and the nervous system alone is the creator of these things? I dispute that. I don't think it is. But you don't need to go to the surround spirits to find it. It's in your own body. The logical march here is from creatures that are alive, have bodies, but don't have nervous systems, to creatures that eventually are alive, have bodies, and have nervous systems. And minds and consciousness are ultimately the product of a particular relationship between the living organism's body and the nervous system in that body. It's not that the nervous system is plucked and put in this inside our bodies, and particularly inside our skull, and charged with creating minds and creating consciousness. Not at all. I mean, of course, you cannot have minds and consciousness without a nervous system. But the nervous system is there as a partner in the process that can lead to better life regulation. The nervous system is a servant of homeostasis, the same way that the body in general is a possessor of homeostatic operations that will allow that organism, that living thing, to continue for an allotted amount of time.
Well, it sounds like there are implications there for those who argue we might be able to upload our brains someday and continue our consciousness. It sounds like you're saying, no, that's not going to be possible. You know, consciousness is not only in the brain, right?
Exactly. So the consciousness, when you analyze what it really means to be conscious, when you come back to the thought that I advanced for you, which is that it's about knowing that I am here in my body, in this life, and that the things that I have in my mind, the representations I have, do not belong somewhere else, do not belong in another organ. They're mine. How do I know that they're mine? Well, they know that they're mine because my nervous system is in constant interaction with the organism in which it is located and without which it could not live. It's not
for people who are not as cognitive scientists, they're maybe listening to some of our conversation. A lot of technical terms we're throwing around. But one implication I see from a lot of this as well with the uploading of the brain is that we may be able to upload and replicate a mind, but not consciousness. I mean, we might not even be able to do the mind, but it seems like at the very best, maybe what we can do is just replicate Scott Barry Kaufman's mind, but I'm never going to be able to identify it with the full organism because it could be sitting in a vat of zero and ones.
Exactly. You got it, and you got it right, and that's exactly it. And that's, of course, we don't need to go there, but that's exactly one of the problems of artificial intelligence right now, that you can, with our current capabilities, we can have something like the contents of your mind in an artificial, non-living creature. If you're going to make it conscious, that's another story. And for that, you know, it's almost an absurdity to think it could be conscious if it's not living, because you know, the entire thing, the entire notion of consciousness is around. Now, you can have simulacra of consciousness. I have no problem with that. In fact, I have a paper that you may know about. It's a paper in Nature Machine Intelligence on how you make this linkage between a robot and a real body with minds and conscious capabilities, and it's an interesting thing to discuss.
That is very interesting, and we are shooting towards the top. I totally get we haven't gone through all the steps yet, and of what is feeling, what is. I have a million other questions that we were supposed to talk about along the way before we get here. But this is really interesting. So while we're here for a second, the idea of can we ever make feeling machines? since we're kind of talking about that right now, I would like to link that to the idea of why is feeling so essential to consciousness in your model, and how do you even define feeling? And then why not? Let's have fun. Let's link that to whether or not we'll be able to create feeling machines as an implication of that.
Okay, very good. Just a little teaching point for people that are sort of caught in the middle of these terms like feeling and emotion. Very often when people think feeling or hear the word feeling, they immediately portray an emotion. And of course, that's the beginning of disaster, because the two things are, in fact, associated one of the time, but plenty of the time they're not. So, and we could start by saying this, what came first, feelings or emotions? And in all likelihood, feelings did. Because feelings are, in fact, mental expressions of certain states of the organism to begin with. And to begin with and to end with, because when you have an emotional feeling, you are also dealing with a state of your organism. But let's start with feelings the way they likely began in the history of life. And the feelings that must have been the first were what I call homeostatic feelings. And they occurred in creatures with nervous systems. That's very important to realize. And by the way, once you remember the strong link that I have between feelings and consciousness, you again have this link between feeling and consciousness and nervous systems. You know, it doesn't make any sense to talk about it if there are no nervous systems. You don't need any feelings if you don't have nervous systems. Anyway, so what feeling, those homeostatic feelings first give in an organism that is multicellular and has nervous systems is a sense, actually a mental representation of something important that is happening in that body, such as, for example, being hungry or being thirsty or having pain or feeling damn good. Those are the fundamental homeostatic feelings. Desire is too, but we don't need to go there. Too early in the morning for desire.
Too early. It's Valentine's Day today. Wait, hold on. We're talking today on Valentine's Day, folks, even though we're going to release this later, just so people know. It's relevant. Go on, yeah.
Okay. So what is hunger telling you? You and only you. It's telling you that it's a good time to have sources of energy brought into your body and that they're lacking. And if you're thirsty, it's telling you something. And by the way, totally conscious right there and then. That's where consciousness first emerges. It's telling you in no uncertain terms, this is lacking. You need this. And of course, it's not telling you in so many words. It doesn't use words. It uses the language of feeling with its spontaneous, natural occurring consciousness. And that's why I like to say that feelings were the inaugural events of consciousness. One fine day, after lots of variations on the theme of organism regulation, this magic potion occurred within living organisms with nervous systems, and that was feeling. And it is so successful. It is so good at telling you immediately, drink, eat, recoil from an attack, do something because you're having pain, and it's probably going to kill you. Do something to prevent it or avoid it or go to the doctor. All of those things were extremely informational. They were giving you there and then useful information to maintain your life. There's no way you could have proceeded life in a complicated organism with multicellular and with nervous system if you did not have that information. In other words, you went rapidly some 500 million years ago, you went rapidly from having organisms that, unless they were lucky, they would die, to organisms that, even if they were not lucky, they had enough information to do something useful about their life and to reduce the risk of death. And this makes perfect sense from an evolutionary perspective. And that's where I think consciousness began. At the level of feeling. Now, because you wanted me to say things about feeling for your listeners, then I will also say that the confusion with emotion is a problem, because what developed in living creatures as emotions, which don't develop with humans, developed before, of course, are theatricals. They're certain kinds of expression that you can have in the body and in the face. Once you have a face that is manipulable with different muscle groups, it's certain kinds of expressions that register something that is happening to you, something that is in the environment, some reaction that you have to others. Examples, a feeling, an emotion of fear when you are recoiling from something that potentially may attack you, and which is accompanied by a feeling of fear. So this is where things get extremely complicated, yeah. And people really need to think a little bit, because then it's clear as daylight. When you are having the emotion of fear, your eyes bulge, you pull back, and lo and behold, your body changed. And because your body changed, those changes are what produce the feeling of fear. But the emotion itself is a set of actions. By the way, the word emotion etymologically is perfect. It's about the Latin emotere. It's to move to the outside. You have, it's actor studio, you know. You're just doing things. And by the way, if you have anger, you do the same thing. You know, it's a different sort of theatricals, but it's again represented in your body. And if you are terribly, if you want to seduce somebody, you also do the corresponding theatricals, and they also are felt because they are represented internally with your nervous system, and they can end up being a feeling which is subjective. Emotions by themselves are not subjective. Emotions by themselves are directed to the outside.
Yeah, so there's something I'm trying to understand about in terms of the chicken and egg thing here. The way you described it, it was like emotions come first and then it influences your feelings. But you had said prior that through the course of human evolution, feelings probably came first.
Exactly. So that's where you need to distinguish between the homeostatic and the emotional in a proper sense. So the things that came first were the homeostatic feelings. And probably the creatures that had homeostatic feelings, if I would have to guess, and I wouldn't bet anything on it, but if I would have to guess, they did not have emotions. They had feelings because they were having representations, mental representations of the state of the body, their bodies. And that was the critical issue here. Mm-hmm. And that's why this has a logic, which is the logic of life and the logic of survival. That came first because it was so important for that organism. When you start having emotions, it's at a point in which you have already some complex interactions with other beings. Wow. And some, those other beings can cross you and you get angry, or they can do something, or the environment can do something that threatens you and you get fear and so forth. So it's a different stage. And it's actually more, it reflects a greater complexity of the organism, although in the end, they don't need to be more complex as phenomena. But they're there reflecting something else. But all of this can end up felt. And felt simply means that you automatically know it's in you. It's in your organism. And that also means that you are automatically conscious. The two things have to go together.
I hear what you're saying. I'm just trying to think this through in my own personal life. Because, my gosh, you're right. We are such social humans. Mm-hmm. The humans are such social beings, I should say. And there is a performative aspect to emotions, which I'm now thinking in my head, like, am I ever, when I'm just having like an imagination of things, do I ever recoil in fear in the same way physically on the outside I would look like if I was with another person and we were both recounting the experience? I'm trying to do the experiment in my head to verify what you're saying scientifically. And it's, yeah, you're right. I never really thought about that, really. Yeah, so we may have feelings when we're lost in our own thoughts and when we're in touch with our own organism, so to speak. but there is something about emotions that is seems like deeply social.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's fascinating. You're right.
Oh, I think it's absolutely social. For example, as you are communicating with me, your face has been animated now several times by, for example, a smile.
True.
You smiled when you were wondering if what I was saying was probably right, and you smile in consonance. But that is, I don't think it's theatrical in the sense that it was totally deliberated by you. It's probably part of your repertoire.
Of
emotional phenomena when you communicate with others, because you have been doing it all your life, and you have adjusted yourself to doing it the same way that I'm sure I've done all sorts of things that would be of that kind. Or, for example, the way your face has, on a couple of times already, manifested doubt in relation to what I was saying, or being puzzled, but puzzled in a way that was probably not positive, which is perfectly fine. But you were registering, or what you're doing right now, you know, which you're, you know, the fact, and I said, it's perfectly fine. You reacted with laughter.
Ooh, and quite big, fine.
Exactly. But that is, it's part of the social interaction. You're doing it along with me in the social interaction. And this has very little to do with being hungry or being thirsty or being in pain. Those are different things. Those are spontaneously occurring in relation to what your nervous system is getting in an interaction with its own body. Mm-hmm. Or I like to say the opposite. It's the organism's own nervous system, because that's the way it is. And it's completely different. By the way, one thing, so that in case we end up, because this is so interesting and we're going in so many directions, so that I don't forget, there's something fundamentally different about the perception of our body by our nervous system and the perception of the outside world. So, for example, right now, I'm perceiving you, and I can look out and perceive the Santa Monica Mountains. There's no way that I can go interactively with the Santa Monica Mountains or with you at the level of the perceptual object. But with my body, that happens. So if my body sends a signal from one particular point, say, for example, I'm having pain in the neck. Sorry to say, you're not a pain in the neck. Anyway, and that's because I was moving books yesterday and the day before. And one of the times I carried too many books in one go, and I twisted muscles, and I have a pain. Mm. What is interesting is that there's signals that are coming from the muscles, that the muscle fibers that have been disrupted and probably torn, and they're going into the spinal cord, in this case, the brainstem, and then the central nervous system. It can go all the way up to the cortex, although in many cases it doesn't need to. Okay. What is interesting is that the signals come in and literally ascend in the nervous system. But the nervous system has the possibility to respond to the origin of the perception. So we have a crosstalk between our body, its non-neural components, and the nervous system. The non-neural components of the body talk to the nervous system. The nervous system talks back. One thing that it does, that you experience constantly, has to do with pain or has to do with itch. For example, if you have an itch in your skin is dry, it's itchy. Well, it's itchy for a little bit. You can scratch it a bit and it will go, but then it will come back. But then after a while, even if you don't do anything about it, it will go. And it will go because the central nervous system is sending signals back to that place, doing at the local level chemical corrections of the environment so that the thing gets adjusted. So it's never the case that you have a body here and a nervous system here, like I have my brain here and you on the screen. there's no way that screen and you are going to do anything to my nervous system directly. Whereas in the case of interoception, that happens all the time. So that's another fundamental way, which, by the way, has been completely neglected by anybody that is doing theory on consciousness, with extremely rare exceptions. There's no way that you can understand this phenomenon without acknowledging that interoception, that is the perception of the interior, quote unquote, is different in its design, in its operation, from the perception of the outside world. These are two things that are completely different. Now, of course, in our high functioning minds and brains, it all works together very well, yet they are different. And it's those differences that give you an entry into problems like consciousness, and that you can explore and exploit to your advantage.
For sure. I mean, if you're a psychopath, you know, you can absolutely, there's a real huge distinction between feelings and emotions. And if you're an actor, there's a huge distinction. But it seems like in most people's everyday lives, there's a great feedback loop between the two that makes it more genuine, so to speak. In my view, there seems to be something different between the way I'm responding to you socially today and an actor would respond to you, because I am feeling things that are correlated at a P less than 0.05 level with the expression on my face. So it's not completely random. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Yeah. And the connection to acting is only useful to give, to bring home the point that certain things can be fabricated at the level of actions, because they are to begin with action. And of course, what we call a great actor is someone that can do those expressions so well that it looks spontaneous and real, as opposed to being fabricated by technique.
Oh, you know what? I would even go one step further and say probably the best actors are those that have a really good congruence between a fabricated emotion and then the genuine experience.
I totally agree. I think that actually speaks to the distinctions, for example, actor studio actors and non-actor studio actors have that kind of difference.
They're good. It's such a talent. It's so amazing. I mean, obviously you learn that, but I do think that there's a certain talent component in there as well. And that's a fascinating question, is what is that talent component? Yeah. You know, that makes you go to that. I love thinking about the aberrations or the outliers to lots of this kind of stuff. You know, we start thinking about things like schizophrenia, you know, and the way that that mind is the different connection, altered brain network connections in people with schizophrenia. Would you say that when they're having a psychotic episode, that they're not, let's say they're having a disassociative episode where they're not identifying the contents of their mind with themselves, would you argue that in those states, schizophrenic patients are not conscious by your definition?
Oh, no. I never argue that. No, I think they are conscious. Okay. Because there is there's something, Scott, something I want to tell you, because you're interested in this, and also to your listeners. There's something very beautiful about feelings, whatever they are. There is the continuity. Homeostatic feelings have a continuity. That's something that a while ago somebody said, oh, so you talk about these homeostatic feelings, and you say that homeostatic feelings are the reason why you're conscious, and that you require them to be conscious spontaneously and so forth. And then, but since I'm not hungry all the time, and I'm not horny all the time, and I'm not thirsty all the time, then what happens? Do I become unconscious in between my hunger and thirst episodes? And I say, no, you're constantly feeling. You have this continuous feeling of being alive. I've called it several times, a feeling of existence, the feeling of being alive. If you meditate a little bit, or if you just be quiet, you realize that there's something humming in you, which is being alive. And which, by the way, if you would not be alive, you would not notice it.
Yeah. Well, do you know that for sure? Are you sure? Do we know that for sure, 100%?
No, I don't.
That's metaphysical.
Yeah. I don't know that for sure. I suspect strongly. Anyway, so this feeling of continuity is extremely important. So when you, I have to tell you that I've not I've thought about feelings in psychiatric conditions. I've on purpose sort of avoided thinking about feelings in schizophrenia, but I've thought about them in depression, for example. And I think there's always a continuity, a feeling of existence. It's there and it's humming along because you are in this interaction between the nervous system and the body. So it's inevitable. So you could say that the other feelings, say feelings of hunger or thirst and so forth, are sort of, if you plot it as a running graph, are things that come, the crest on top of that humming up and down feeling that is constantly there on your monitor. That is the feeling of life, the feeling of existence.
But as I understand your theory, feeling is a necessary but not sufficient condition for consciousness. In order for consciousness to occur, there needs to be this real coordinated operation of being, feeling, and knowing. And it does seem like in certain schizophrenic patients, the knowing part is not there. So that's why I ask you the very pointed question. According to your definition, it seems like you would say that they're not conscious, even though they're feeling.
No, but I think that the way in which you're taking that combination of being, feeling, and knowing is not as literal as that. So, of course, I mean, what are the conditions? You have to have a living organism. You have to have an organism that has a nervous system. You have the possibility of interactions of the nervous system and the rest of the body. And then you have the sort of bubbling up sense, which is a feeling, that there is life ticking in there. The knowing, it's a very interesting question. Do you need to be, in addition to it being there spontaneously, no questions asked? Do we need to have a reflection on it? I don't think so. And I think that what is failing in schizophrenia is at the level of a reflection on what is happening in that organism.
BA10.
Is that?
BA10.
Yeah. So, right. So the
cognition. Yeah.
The spontaneous feeling of existence is still there. It doesn't go away. But it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm not letting this go. I'm not letting this go because it is very it raises a lot of interesting questions. Dissociative episodes.
I'm going to think very carefully about your question on schizophrenia, and I will send you an answer.
Thank you. I really, truly appreciate that. This is what a good scholarly conversation is about. So we're modeling that right now. So wonderful, beautiful. Let's talk about creativity a little bit. You know, it's a topic we both love. And the neuroscience of creativity. I know you're very interested in complex emotions, things like the bittersweet. You know, my friend Susan Cain just wrote a whole book about this emotion, bittersweet. But I know that you're really interested in mixed valence emotions. And I'm absolutely enamored with that as well. What's the role of these kinds of mixed emotions in helping us have more complex cognitive processes like creativity and meaning making? Fair question?
Everything is fair. It goes in the mix. You know, creativity is such an extraordinary field to look at. I think that depending on, you see, it all depends on what you're working on. If you're writing literary sentences, or if you're making a painting or a sculpture, they're very different levels of operation, different complexities, and they all take. They all exploit this amazing high level of consciousness that we have gotten to, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why people are so confused about consciousness and why it is so difficult to bring them down to the simple fact that feelings are spontaneous events in consciousness. Because most of what people have been thinking and reading about creativity, about consciousness, has pulled them up and has taken them to not only high-level consciousness, but to the consequences of high-level consciousness in the form of the creative objects that are around us. So nobody ever started looking at consciousness from the bottom up. People start looking at consciousness in the extended consciousness
totally.
That occurs when we have when we have this sort of literary sense of the universe together with the science that has accompanied it. And creativity is so central to this. But again, it sort of pushes you up where you have consequences of being conscious, but where the real operations are no longer in the domain of consciousness, but rather in the domain of knowledge and creativity, in the domain of manipulation of knowledge. Now, of course, you couldn't manipulate that knowledge if you were not conscious to begin with, if you had not been so richly conscious that you gave to every little bit of knowledge that you have in your brain right now, you gave it the gift of consciousness, which really means you gave it the possibility of connecting with your life. Mm. That's it. You're conscious, even if you're thinking, you have just been listening to a particular passage of Mozart or Bach, those are so incredibly complex in the way they were written or in the way they're being performed by a superb soloist. And that is only available to you if you can bring down that thread into your body and if you can connect it to the state of your body at that moment. That's when consciousness occurs. But of course, we have spent most of our lives thinking about it from the top at the level of extended consciousness, which is not even a good name. I coined it, so it's my fault. But yeah. But I don't like to use extended. It's extended mind, really, not consciousness.
Well, I completely agree with what you just said, and it links to my own work on reduced latent inhibition and creativity mm-hmm. and creative achievement. Work I did in my dissertation, where creative people tend to have this reduced threshold for that pre-gating mechanism for kind of allowing in some of that more sensory information and not tagging things as irrelevant. This is also work that obviously like people like Jordan Peterson and Shelley Carson did as well. So I think that's more of a bottom-up approach along the lines of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very good.
Very good, yes. I got a very good from the famous Antonio Damasio. Yay. You know, in another area of creativity that I really am fascinated with, which I nerd out a lot with our mutual friend and colleague Mary Helen Immerdino Yang, is the default mode network. And I'm wondering, I want to hear your thoughts about the default. I just saw your emotion there on your face there when I said default mode network. What are your thoughts on that and its linkage to creativity?
It's too early in the morning for default mode network.
I love that.
Yeah, I love that. I'm still half asleep.
You don't want to go there. Well, it does seem like the default mode network, which is a network of brain areas in the medial surface of the prefrontal cortex, primarily, that seems to support a lot of different forms of social cognition, imagination, mental time travel into the future. And as Mary Helen Immerdino Yang has talked about, its connection to meaning making and mm-hmm. how that could potentially be connected to creativity. Do you personally, in your own work, do you see that as a central hub of creativity? Of the neuroscience of creativity?
I certainly see it as a very important component, a very important contributor. I don't know if I would call it the central hub, but certainly something
extreme. And important.
Absolutely. Yeah. You should talk about it. You know about it.
I know about it. Well, the thing that fascinates me about the default mode network and in relation to our conversation today is that you can kind of... To be poetic about it, when you're jamming in the space of your default network, when you're improvising, when you're just in touch with the stream of your mind, not necessarily consciousness, but the mind, right? The stream of mind, or William James, you know, called it. Yeah. He called it the stream of consciousness, but he should have called it the stream of mind. I just realized that. But it seems like when we're jamming in the stream of our mind, great, amazing, creative things come out. You know, when you're doing jazz improvisation, when you're trying to get in this state where you're doing poetry. So it does seem like consciousness is not consciousness can even get in the way sometimes of creative generation.
It could. That's a perfectly reasonable thought. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It might not be bad at certain points to sort of separate yourself from that hook, from the fangs of consciousness.
Yeah.
Maybe that's exactly, flights of poetic fancy are exactly moments in which you make that link more tenuous. How about that?
Yeah. And obviously we can't stay in that state all the time, 24/7.
It wouldn't be good for...
It wouldn't be. See, that's another interesting correlate, because then it would move you away from the really life-saving consequences of being conscious, which basically have to do with house management. You know, consciousness is very simple. It's all about keeping the thing going as well as possible. And then there's the flights of fancy. That's in another sphere.
Another sphere. Yeah.
Can I have a question? I know I will have to go very, very soon. So can I ask you a question?
Of course.
So are you really interested in panpsychism?
I think it's interesting theory, but I don't, I'm very skeptical. Very skeptical of it, yeah.
You don't buy it.
I'm skeptical of it. I haven't not bought it yet. I haven't bought it yet either. I'm still thinking about whether I should buy it. But I'm skeptical. But some of my closest friends, Annika Harris, in her own right, she wrote a book on consciousness. She loves it. She loves it. Philip Goff loves it. He was on my podcast. He was extolling the merits of it.
I know. There are people that are very much like us, people that can think that way. There's nothing wrong with it other than being wrong. There's nothing wrong with falling for it. There's wrong if you fall for it forever.
Well, I will say, sort of ending here today, I really do see the logic of what you've outlined and why consciousness seems to require the coordinated effort of these three, we call them systems in a way, these three elements of the body that interacting with each other in very unique ways. But this element that the nervous system is an important part of it does have deep implications. We never answered the machine question, so maybe we should end on that one, because we had that's a thread that's still open. Can we ever have feeling machines? And you have argued in your book, a new generation of feeling machines can probably become efficacious assistants to really feeling humans. As hybrids of natural and artificial creatures, no less important, this new generation of machines would constitute a unique laboratory for the investigation of human behavior and mind in a variety of actual realistic settings. So that's exciting coming down the pipeline, when we can start to meld fast computer processors with the nervous system. So we can get the coordinated effort of the elements you talk about in a way where it has like a super duper hyped up processing capability. That could produce some interesting forms of consciousness, right?
Absolutely. And you would have to have some kind of body aspect to it. In other words, you will need to mimic certain properties of a living organism in order to get to it with any hope of success. Mm. And right now we don't have that, but I think it's perfectly possible. Yeah.
It's possible. Yeah. Antonio, oh my man, thank you so much for this chat today. It really was delightful to talk to you. We should keep up the nerdy conversation.
Very good. Any time. I enjoyed talking to you. It was fun.
It was so much fun. Best of luck with your book.
Okay. Bye-bye. Take care.
You too. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.